So the topic for tonight's talk is seven skillful moves. And I want to talk about seven classic tools that are used in this process of awakening. For any problem or difficulty that we might have in life, there are a number of different tools usually that we can use, or strategies that we can approach the problem with. And a problem as broad and comprehensive as the problem of suffering in life invites many different skillful approaches. And although there are some Buddhist schools that are dedicated to a single approach or a very streamlined way of tackling the problem, and might even articulate theirs as the only way, or the most direct way, or the best way, or the Buddhist way, I feel that meditation should not be reduced to the development of a single factor, or the refinement of a single technique. Even a glance at the Buddhist discourses show that the Buddha was extraordinarily adept at presenting a variety of techniques, a variety of approaches. He simply taught differently for different people. He taught differently for people with different aptitudes, different faculties, different abilities, different interests, different occupations in life, different amounts of time they could dedicate to the practice. Differently for lay people or differently for monastics, depending on their commitments and their interest. This development of skillful means, the term that we usually translate into English as skillful means, is in Pali upaya. Upaya is based on the capacity to discern what approach is going to be useful given the conditions now. Even fabulous tools like mindfulness and concentration represent only a few of the ways that we work with the mind to confront this problem of suffering. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this beautiful text called the Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha, or in Pali, the Majjhima Nikaya. But what I'm going to talk about tonight is basically a reflection on number two in this discourse, in this book, the second discourse called All the Taints. The term that we use in English as taint, in Pali the term is asavas. Now this is a confusing term because even in English, the variety of translations are also just as confusing. Cankers, influxes, corruptions, intoxicants, biases, taints. Now, for those of you that don't use English on a regular basis, may find those words rather bewildering. But don't worry, because when I say those words at home, everybody just says, "What?" Those are not even words that we use on a regular basis. Nobody, I mean, I could go through years without using any of those words or ever seeing them in anything other than an ancient Buddhist text. So I asked Karen to put up the Hebrew definition of asavas, not knowing if it would be any clearer than the English. But what word did you put up for the asavas?
Mujamim, or machimim. But it's also not a direct translation of inflow, outflow, asavas. It's a difficult term.
Yeah, it's a very difficult term. But then when you look at what the three or the four taints are, most commonly you find three listed, but there are some places in the texts where they threw in a fourth. Well, you can spell them out as four, or you can put the three and the four both in the category of ignorance, because it kind of fits there too. But when you look at it as a list of four, we have the taint, or the asava, of sense desire, the taint of desiring eternal existence, the taint of wrong view, or the taint of ignorance. And it's often the wrong view one that's absent from the list when you get just the three. These are basically what we abandon in our practice. And it's the absence of these, the destruction of these, that define the state of the awakened mind, or the arahant. We'll find in the text references to when one whose taints are destroyed, and when one is referring to the person whose taints are destroyed, it's one saying the enlightened one, or the arahant. Or it may say in the texts, the aim of concentration is to concentrate the mind for the destruction of the taints, or to develop mindfulness for the destruction of the taints, or to practice to cultivate the mind for the destruction of the taints. In this discourse, in number two, All the Taints, in the middle-length discourses, the Buddha defines the problem of these taints, of sense desire, the desire for internal existence, for ignorance and of wrong view. And he reveals the goal of liberation as the experience that is free from these obstructions or these corruptions or taints. And then he describes a range of skillful means or methods for abandoning these particular taints in order to realize the peace of release. I like this discourse because the Buddha does not just say, now watch the taints arise and pass and go back to your breath. Although many beginners might think that that's what we're supposed to do in practice, is just to watch the states arise and pass and go back to our breath. Now, mindfulness certainly is a primary approach that we cultivate. But the Buddha talks about developing other abilities as well, often aspects that are a little bit more dynamic and active ways of engaging with these basic forces of craving and of ignorance in the mind. So in this discourse, the teaching begins with the instruction to reflect wisely, emphasizing that this is a wisdom teaching. It's a teaching on how to live and how to practice wisely, how to encounter our life with clarity and wisdom, how to make decisions and choices that are informed by wisdom. We select the appropriate approach, the skillful means, based upon wise reflection, and then we continue to reflect upon the experience and the development of that practice to see how it's working, because that's how we hone the wisdom, that's how we sense whether it really is wise or not, or if it needs to be adjusted. We apply our wisdom to discern how to approach these various conditions of mind, because wisdom is not an intellectual knowledge, but it's a recognition of causes and effects. So we continue to look into our experience to see what is the cause of this and what is the effect of it. How is it occurring now? What is coming together that this experience is dependent upon? The Buddha says in this discourse, when one attends unwisely, unarisen taints arise and arisen taints increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen taints do not arise and arisen taints are abandoned. Now, this is the kind of discourse that it's sort of fun to try and read repeatedly really fast several times and see if you can keep the uns and the wises and the unwises correct and straight without getting them twisted. But basically, you look into your experience as you're doing something and you see whether or not the problems are increasing or if they're decreasing, whether the wholesome states, whether you're coming closer to your goal or you're not. Basically, whether the strategy that you've adopted is working or not. And a lot of the development of wisdom is as simple as this: to look into your life and to consider, how is it that you're approaching something, and is it working? If it's not working, then let it go and try something else. Even if you don't know to something else, whether it's going to be any better. If you are convinced that the strategy you've been taking, maybe a habit that you've been pursuing, maybe a pattern that's been with you for decades, is always leading to the same result, suffering, conflict, confusion, agitation. When you know that, what's the wise thing to do? It's to stop doing it and try something else. And then watch what happens with that something else and see if that leads to a state of greater peace or not. And so we learn in that simple way. It sounds simple, but it requires a lot to actually stop a pattern, to first reflect on it, to stop a pattern and to realize that there are alternatives. Now, the Buddha didn't teach that every spiritual practice should be undertaken, and he also didn't say that every spiritual practice should not be undertaken. He didn't say that everything was good to do or that anything in particular was bad to do. He said that what should be practiced are the things that increase the wholesome states of mind and decrease the unwholesome states of mind. And so we keep looking into our experience to assess is the approach that we're taking increasing the wholesome and decreasing the unwholesome. He said, "I do not say that all undertakings should be performed, nor do I say of all undertakings that they should not be performed. I do not say that every spiritual effort should be done, or that every act of renunciation carried out, nor do I say of every spiritual effort that it should not be done, nor of every act of renunciation that it should not be carried out. In performing undertakings, making spiritual efforts, carrying out acts of renunciation, if unwholesome states grow, then I declare these practices should not be carried out. But if in performing undertakings, making spiritual efforts, and carrying out acts of renunciation, unwholesome states wane and diminish, and wholesome states grow and increase, then I declare these practices should be carried out." So it's a simple reflection to see what the result is of whatever it is we're trying. But it does require that each of us look into that experience for ourselves. In this discourse, in number two in the Middle Length Discourses, he discusses seven basic ways of tackling these defilements of mind. These approaches include insight, restraint, using, enduring, avoiding, removing, and developing. And I'm going to take these point by point. The first of insight. Insight is also understood to be clear seeing, seeing things as they actually are. How we relate to phenomenon, whether it's wise or unwise, will determine if those defilements will increase or weaken. Some things are considered fit for our attention, and other things are considered unfit for attention. The difference is known by the effects in how we perceive them, how we give attention to them. So if we find that the obstructions strengthen, and that the agitation increases, that we get more irritable, that conflict increases, then it would be unwise to continue to attend to them. The traditional example is of speculative thought. You know, if we start pondering about what was happening in the past, and why am I this way, and what was the cause of this, and what was the origin of my life, and what kind of a person I am, and what did my mother say to me when I was 4 years old, and why did she say that to me, and da 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 da. That's one way in the past. Another kind of speculation is, how am I going to be in the future? How am I going to present myself? How am I going to be seen? what will happen in the future. If this happened, then this might happen. And if that happened, then this, then this, then this, then this, then this, then this, then this. Most people imagine a scenario that's much worse than whatever actually happens. But then we think, oh, well, what if that doesn't happen? Then this might happen. And then this could happen, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen, this can happen, which is also equally bad, just in a different way. And we imagine all of these scenarios of what might happen in the future. In the text, it says, the questions were, was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he was inwardly perplexed about the present. Thus, am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from and where will it go? Now, these questions that obsessed ancient practitioners are not so different than the questions that we ponder about. Just consider for yourself in your meditations today, did you have any thoughts about yourself in the past or yourself in the future or any commentary describing yourself in the present moment? I'm sitting here just like a Buddha. Everybody must be seeing how enlightened I am. Or, oh, I bet everybody hates me because I'm so restless. You know, all this self stuff. Imagining past, imagining future, imagining who and how we are in the present. We indulge our attention in these thoughts. And when we indulge in these sorts of thoughts, very often doubt increases, confusion increases, restlessness and agitation. Plus, the wrong view of self. So we can consider, is this obsession with self leading to the goal of liberation? Is it increasing our peace and ease and joy in life? Or is this one of those patterns that every time we look at it, we actually find it's causing us more trouble than it's worth? If we discover that every time we see ourselves fretting about the future, worrying about things, and we realize, whoa, that's really consistently leading to greater suffering, then it can inspire us to want to alter that habit. But first we need this insight to consider and to see clearly the pattern and to reflect upon it. Now, wise attention is considered the opposite, of course, of unwise attention. Unwise attention occupies the mind with things that lead to confusion. They're usually based on concepts. They're not seeing things as they actually are. And we usually miss the basic fact that everything is changing because we're holding things to be how it was, how I was, how things are, my view, and how things will be, my fear. But on the opposite side, there's wise attention. And wise attention is an ability to discern the Four Noble Truths right in the midst of our actions, right in the midst of our lived experience, to literally frame our experience, to know this is suffering, this is dukkha, this is the cause of suffering, this is the ending of the cause of suffering, and this is the way leading to the ending of suffering. And it's a radically different perspective to sit and to experience pain in the body and to have the unwise attention say, oh no, my elbow hurts. I will never again be able to play tennis. And then I will grow fat because I can't exercise and die a boring life, or da, 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 you know, whatever. You know, like the mind goes on and on and on about a future based upon some little sensation. Very different than saying, oh, there is pain in the body. There's dissatisfaction with the body. This is dukkha. There's a cause of dukkha. What's the cause of dukkha? It's wanting something other than it is. It's attachment to a condition that is not present. So it's, in this case, attachment to an elbow that doesn't hurt. And then what's the ending of dukkha? Well, the ending isn't to cut off the elbow and throw it away. The ending is to free the mind from that attachment to that concept of what isn't real. And then we simply open to the realization of what is, and we practice the way to the end of suffering. This is a very different orientation that, in a way, takes the self-concept out of experience so that we start to orient to every experience of mind or of body as a realization of the Four Noble Truths, of suffering and the end of suffering. So this is the insight. This is a way of dealing with the taints of craving or of ignorance through insight. The second is restraint, restraining. What needs to be restrained? What needs to be kept in check, abandoned, let go, held in check? Well, it's said that the eye faculty, the ear faculty, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. Because if they're unrestrained, if they're undisciplined, if they're not held in check with mindfulness, then they will get us into trouble. The tongue will get seduced into some taste and want more and then more and then more and then more and then more until we're kind of sick. The body might get swept away by soft touches and lose all sense of responsibility. The eye can become overcome by the desire for sight, and lead to dangers. I had a friend who was driving to the, almost had an accident driving to the Grand Canyon in the United States, because you turn one bend as you're driving for hours through the desert, hours and hours and hours, and then you turn around this corner, and all of a sudden there's this incredible expanse, and so beautiful that she lost track of which side of the road she was on and almost had an accident because of the incredible, awesome sight of this wonder of nature. Okay, so that's one thing. Fortunately, she did get back into her lane and stop, and it was all okay. But there's signs now, there's signs posted places to, pull over here, don't look while you're driving and things like that. I've known people who, see a person that they find very attractive and can't help but look as they're walking, and bump into something. is it a Greek myth of the siren, the beautiful sound, and the sound was so beautiful of the siren, of this. I think a Greek god or Greek Odysseus, yes. And that is lost. Somebody who's completely lost by that sound. And sometimes we can really lose ourselves, lose our sense of priorities, lose our mission, lose our purpose when we are lost in the senses in that way. If we can just pause and restrain the senses and restrain that impulse towards stimulation, then there's the possibility for a more quiet world of clarity to open for us, to use the potential that we have to learn and to explore and to transform the conditioned tendencies. Perhaps the stimulation that we seek most often isn't even through the senses. Sometimes we'll come in here and we'll sit down, we'll cross our legs, and we'll restrain all the other senses except the mind. And it goes off into a fantasy of our own making that has nothing to do with anything we are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, or touching. And yet we are completely lost into that stimulation, that entertainment, that story. And so we also in this have to consider the mind as one of the sense faculties. Sense restraint is a very important part of the development of the spiritual life, because without it, we function on automatic. whether we're lost in a pattern of conditioning from childhood or from lifetimes before, who knows? Or maybe we operate almost instinctively, not so different than an animal that just seeks pleasure and avoids pain. But Buddhist practices encourage us to develop a kind of intelligent restraint. It's not a mortification of the senses. It's not a kind of penance or physical torture in any way. We're not asked to sleep on a bed of nails. We're not asked to whip ourselves or to do extreme fasts or to torture the body in any way at all. The Buddha spoke against those sorts of extreme practices, which were done in his time. We restrain the senses by guarding them, by protecting them, by preventing them from going out. And what is the guard of our senses? It is mindfulness. It is mindfulness that guards the senses. The third way of approaching these taints, or asavas, is by using. I always liked this one, because some people think, oh, asavas, you just abandon them all, abandon them all, abandon them all, cut them off, throw them away. But no, he says there's also using is a way of approaching, is one of the skillful means. There are some things that must be used. The path is not just about letting go, but it's also a wise use of our resources and our material things. Now, in the monastic life, there are what are called the four requisites, and those include the robe, the food, the shelter, and the medicines. And these are things that all human beings require. In terms of the robe, I think we can take this as a kind of model for, although we're not monastics, we can consider what would be a lay version of considering the use of clothing. Well, it's to keep ourselves warm and to dress appropriately for our social, for our society, you know, to cover ourselves appropriately for basic privacy. In this practice, we can simply dress simply. Not a lot of ornamentation, not a lot of designer labels. We don't have to come to a retreat with matching shoes and a matching purse and a matching shawl for every outfit. We still wear clothes. The Buddha didn't encourage us to go around naked like the naked ascetics of his time. His approach was that of moderation, to use clothing, but to just use it simply. To use it wisely. When I was practicing in the monasteries, I didn't ordain, but I practiced as a lay person. So I just wore, you know, I had a couple of outfits made, all the same color, and that was what I wore for a few years. And, you know, it was a little confusing, I must say, to come home and to try and figure out, oh, I have to match my socks with my shirt, or I have to match my pants with my jacket. It was a very confusing thing. It's very simple to just put on clothes and to just have them be appropriate to the climate. There, it keeps life very nice. The second is food, and it's to use food that is suitable and sustaining to the body. The Buddha did not present a best diet. He didn't say that one food was more pure than another kind of food. In fact, he criticized many of the current customs that elevated certain kinds of food as being more pure or more holy or more this or more that than any other kind of food. He said that a monk or nun reflecting wisely takes food neither for enjoyment nor for indulgence nor for physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the upkeep and sustenance of this body, for avoiding harm to it, and for supporting the holy life, thinking, I shall put a stop to old feelings of hunger, and I shall not arouse new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and live in comfort. We can use this reflection and keep this in mind when we eat. We're very fortunate here to have lovely, healthy food that's provided at each meal. When I was in the monasteries, we would take this reflection and chant it before eating. So we'd get our bowl, and then we would chant this reflection so that as we looked at our food, we would reflect on how we were going to eat it, what attitude we were going to take. Fasting is not a spiritual ideal in the Buddhist tradition. The Buddha encouraged us to eat, but to eat food wisely, without either excess or indulgence, without the craving and the preoccupation with food, but also to include the wise consideration and to find the food that is appropriate for our health. The third requisite is the resting place, the sleeping place, and to use that sleeping place as a protection from cold and heat, flies, wind, and dangers. Now, for lay people, this might include just a consideration of how we relate to our own homes. What do we actually need in our homes, and what do we need in a home? Sometimes people have homes that become burdens to them. They're quite excessive. So many appliances, there isn't any place to put them all on the countertops, or just a complexity in the home life that is more burdensome than supportive. So it's worth considering what you need in a home, because the Buddha acknowledged that we do need protection from these elements. We do need a home, but how do we want to make that home? How do we want to use, then, the square footage that we live within? I've practiced and taught at a number of meditation centers in various countries that developed actually because somebody who had the good fortune to have a home with a great deal of land around it offered a piece of their property for a meditation group to start, usually while they were alive. And the meditation group formed, and then it developed. And I know a number of centers that just developed over time so that a generous person who had the space offered this place. And it continued, and after the death in a number of places, nonprofits formed and purchased the place, or it was inherited, or the heirs sold it at a very cheap rate to the meditation groups. And centers grew up out of the spirit of generosity of the person who lived there. And it's quite an amazing thing to see when somebody makes their own home a spiritual place and really finds that their house then supports the spiritual life. Some people have the remarkable ability and the conditions to do this in a big way that affects a whole community and really starts a meditation center in a place. And other people do it in small ways, offering their house for a study group once a week or once a month, or inviting friends from the Dhamma over for tea once a month, and just having within their home life a spiritual place, a spiritual dialogue, a spiritual engagement. Some people do it just by creating a kind of sacred place within their home so that there's a corner that's used for meditation, or a room that's set aside and used for meditation or yoga or something, so that there is something within the home itself that is of value, that is designated and valued for the spiritual life. The fourth requisite is medicines and the taking of care of our health and considering what we use, the things that we take in. And medicines are not considered to be entertainment. They're not for quick highs or for beautification or for recreational use. This aspect of considering the medicines is considering how do we use things, and to consider how much confusion and angst is caused when we forget the purpose of the things that we use. How much money do we spend on frivolous material pursuits? Many people complicate their basic needs for house, for vehicle, for clothing, for medicine, for food, with all kinds of other attributes, such as status or power or identity. I don't know if it's as strong here, but in the States, there seems to be a very strong identification with people's vehicles for some reason. It's a part of our culture. And people really care a lot about the car that they drive. And they really notice the cars that other people drive. I don't. Is it similar here or not? Not so. You did, yes. Okay. Some people really, really care about what car they drive because it says something about who they are and where they position themselves and what their personality is like and what kind of a person they are, whether they're adventurous or whether they're sweet or whether they're a family person or whether they're a this or whether they're a that. And it's like a lot is communicated through these vehicles or these styles. But really, what's a car for? It's to get you from place to place. And you need a certain size if you've got kids that you're schlepping around. You need a different size if you've got stuff that you're schlepping around. And if you're not schlepping anything but yourself, you need less. You know, it just depends upon what you need. For lay people, we have to consider how we use our money, how we use our time, how do we earn our livelihood, and how do we spend what we earn. What is a wise relationship to money? Do we use our resources for the benefit of our families and our communities? Do we save what we need to save? Do we give what we have to give? And do we need what it is that we use? If we reflect on our material affairs, we see that basically we can bring wisdom to consider what it is that we need and use it wisely, and then free ourselves from the fear and the anxiety that keeps us attached to material assets, fearing that we'll never have enough. The wise use of things is a very important component of generosity. How much we have in our bank account has nothing to do with generosity. Some of the sweetest acts of generosity that I have witnessed have been performed by people who are materially relatively poor. We have to consider when we give, what is it, not just what is it that we're giving, but how is it that we're giving? What's the spirit of mind that gives? Is there any holding back? For some people, giving a tiny amount is a very big stretch because there is so little in the bank to give. For other people, they could give a massive amount before it would even start to feel like a stretch, even start to even feel generous. So can we each bring ourselves in that practice of generosity to the edge so that we're developing the quality of generosity in how we give? When we consider what we how we use what we have, we can think realistically about what we need in our lives and trust that we have enough to share so that we can delight and find joy in the act of giving. Amazingly, it always seems there's enough to share of something. As the Buddha said, if people knew as I know the result of giving and sharing, they would not eat a meal without sharing it, nor would they allow the stain of meanness to obsess them and take root in their minds. Even if it were their last mouthful, they would not eat a meal without having shared it. So how we use things is important. The fourth approach to these asavas is that of enduring. And I love that the Buddha said that there are some troubles that are best worked with by enduring. And what should be abandoned by enduring, he asked. Here, a bhikkhu reflecting wisely bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life, while taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things. There are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who endures them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by enduring. He didn't say to endure misspelled words. Sorry, I had to correct that. The summary of the things to endure is basically nature, pain, climate, and the words and actions of others. You know, if we just took this list and just did this practice, imagine your family if nobody ever complained about pain, nature, climate, or the words and actions of others. Would it be different? Would there be much left to complain about? You know, there's a lot that we can just simply endure. And why do we endure it? We endure it because we have no control over it anyway. No matter how much we complain about the weather or nature or pain or the words and actions of others, it's the way it is anyway. So why complain about it? Why struggle over it? Why suffer over it? If there is something that we cannot change and that we cannot fix, then we simply accept them as inconveniences. We endure them. We accept that they're present, and we're wise enough to be patient enough to experience these truths, though they're inconvenient, without rushing that they be different or the way that we design. We don't need to grit our teeth to resist the truth of things. Enduring invites a more measured response. It's a steady, equanimous acceptance that things are not the way that we would have planned them. As simply as that. It's not the way we would have designed it. We didn't want that person to speak to us that way. But they did. We didn't want the rain to be during that particular walking meditation. But it did. We didn't want this or that, the mosquito to be in our bedroom at night. But it was there. So, why complain? The fourth approach to these asanas or skillful means is to avoid. Okay, this is a nice one. Some things can be best worked with by avoiding. Now, you're getting the idea that mindfulness isn't the only strategy, right? So what should be avoided? Here, a bhikkhu reflecting wisely avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull. This is very good advice. A wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, and a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering in unsuitable resorts, and associating with bad friends. Now, sometimes the list needs a slight bit of cultural translation to update it a little bit. But the basic idea is that sometimes we can save ourselves a great deal of suffering and remove the potential causes of suffering just by avoiding dangerous situations. But notice that the Buddha did not say that one should avoid pain. That was in the enduring category. Sorry. That was in the enduring category. So sometimes we try to avoid the thing that we should endure, and we try to endure sometimes the things that we should avoid. So it is worth considering these categories. He described these things to avoid as things that present mental or physical dangers to us. Now, sewers and cesspits and wild animals could represent physical dangers, dangers to our health or to our life. And reckless association with those conditions can just simply be reckless and lead to great suffering. His teaching was not to prove that we were courageous, by diligently sitting in front of a wild tiger. Actually, you should stand up. You shouldn't sit down if you're in front of a wild tiger. But it's not to put ourselves in situations of great danger, not to try to prove our faith by sitting at the edge of a cliff in a hurricane, or to basically not to do something that's foolish. We intelligently avoid certain conditions because they're more likely to bring more harm than benefit. Now, the reference to the unsuitable seats is often a confusing one. You wonder, well, what's an unsuitable seat? Well, that was a way of saying that a monk, you know, the seats in India are often like this. They're really like a bed, you know, and at night they roll out a bedroll on it, and during the day they sit on them as a seat. And so an unsuitable seat would, for a monk and a laywoman, to be alone on a seat like this, because it could develop in a direction that is not so celibate. So that would be considered an unsuitable seat. But there are lots of parallels. I mean, we may think, oh, that's so monastic. But I have interviews all the time with students who come and tell me that, you know, that they're in a marriage, a committed relationship, or a monogamous relationship, and they find themselves attracted to somebody else. And they have to consider how they're going to relate to that. And usually in the conversation, we discuss it. And if they're clear that they want to maintain their relationship, their committed relationship, then they need to not sit on unsuitable seats. You know, they need to avoid certain conditions that are very likely to bring trouble and to bring harm. And so that simple practice of avoiding those conditions can save lay people a great deal of grief and suffering. So there's the wonderful practice of just, you know, monastics. If when I have an interview with the monastic, the door is left open. It's not closed. So there's usually always somebody else in the room. And if somebody isn't in the room, or even if somebody is, then the door is left open so that there aren't the conditions possible for either anything suggestive to occur, or for anybody to think that something suggestive could have occurred. And I think as lay people, we can consider some of these things just to make life a lot more peaceful for ourselves. In a similar way, somebody who's an alcoholic, it would be unsuitable to hang out in a bar or to attend parties where drinking was expected. As somebody who's recovering from an addiction might even avoid association with friends, even old friends who were addicts. Someone addicted to shopping or who was already in debt might avoid the possession of a credit card, might actually get rid of all credit cards. But on a subtler level, we can avoid a lot of restlessness, a lot of agitation in our retreats just by considering what we might avoid in the days prior to a retreat. I don't know how many of you prepared for this retreat by doing something a little different in your life. At home, I encourage people before they go on to a retreat to not watch movies, you know, to not read novels in the days before a retreat, to certainly not watch television. I mean, to watch what we stuff into our minds, because you might end up watching replays of it when you're sitting in the silence again. We can avoid a lot of agitation if we watch how much sugar or caffeine we take in, or what we're sensitive to. When we know what seduces us from our goal, we have many options to avoid it. The next way of working with the asavas is by removing. And now this is probably what we're most familiar with. What do we remove? What do we abandon? Well, the Buddha said there were three things that we remove. We remove thoughts or intentions of sensual desire, thoughts or intentions of ill will, and thoughts or intentions of cruelty. We don't tolerate those in our minds. We don't just watch them arise. We don't endure them. We don't use them. These we abandon. These we remove. In a way, we clean up our own minds. So we're not removing the things that somebody else does. We're really removing our own intentions and unwholesome action, unwholesome intentions. And I appreciate that what it is that we remove isn't a physical thing. It's simply this intention or this, it's an intention of mind. There are some things that I think we can be very strong about in our practice, very rigorous. Some things that, you know, we talk about acceptance and openness and allowing a lot in the practice. And I had one teacher who was so accepting and so allowing and so open, except for this. And it was very powerful for me because she did not tolerate at all an unwholesome intention, not in her mind, nor in a student's mind. And, you know, just the recognition of an aversive thought, it was like, remove that, abandon it. Don't tolerate that in your own mind. You know, you'd want to clean up your own mind. You want to clean up your own act. The last of the seven ways of working with the asavas is through developing. What do we develop? Well, this sutta gives us the list of the seven factors of enlightenment. So we develop mindfulness, energy or effort, investigation, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And there are many good qualities that we develop in this practice, probably too many to name. But as our practice matures, we'll find that a whole host of wholesome states are developing and being cultivated. As you go about this retreat, especially at this time in the retreat, I encourage you to really understand that this practice is a lot more than just following the rudiments of the schedule. At this point in the practice, I want to encourage you to really hold the day very fully. Some of you may have noticed that there's more time around the meal periods than it actually takes to chew and swallow your food. And so you might wonder, oh, what do you get to do with that extra time? Does that mean you get three naps in a day after each meal? They weren't scheduled in there as nap time. If you're tired and you need to take a little bit of rest that's okay. But it's understood in the schedule that there are some activities like work periods that have to happen, so we needed to put some time in for that. But also, I think it's really important that we each find our own way to extend our practice. For some of you, that'll mean that after the meal, you'll go out and you'll do a walking meditation to bring up the energy a little bit. Or you'll go for a walk for the health of getting a little movement in the body. Or you'll find a place outside and just do standing meditation under a tree. Some of you will realize, oh, the hall is here. The door's not locked. Why not come in and just practice longer? So I'm hoping at this point in the retreat, you'll start to extend the sittings a little bit by seeing around the mealtime if you either add a walking meditation, a standing meditation outside, or come in earlier for the sitting. If you wake up earlier, to go ahead and use that time for practice. If you're awake at night, to use that time for practice. To use every moment that you can for the development of this practice. Spiritual endeavor includes the cultivation of the good as well as the abandoning of the harmful. In the Dhammapada it says, do no evil, engage in what is skillful, and purify your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So just to wrap up, I've presented seven basic ways of training the mind and destroying the asavas. Those include insight, restraint, using, enduring, avoiding, removing, and developing. When we skillfully combine these seven approaches, we can work diligently and easily with anything that might arise in our minds. And then we continue to wisely reflect.
we continue to study the mind, to look into the mind. We may find sometimes that there's a problem that needs to be addressed, and we can consider, should I address that by avoiding, by abandoning, by using, by insight? How should we address that? But we might also find that there are times when the mind is utterly beautiful, clean, clear, bright, and it needs nothing at all. The simile that's given in the discourses is that the purity of seeing one's own mind is likened to a youth who admires her face in the mirror. And if she sees a blemish on her face, she would clean it. But if she sees that there is no blemish, then she would abide happy that the face is free from dirt or from blemishes. Similarly, when we look in the mind and we review our own minds, if we find that there is something that is a blemish in the mind, something that is an obstruction or a disturbance, then we work with it skillfully and wisely. But if we look in the mind and we find that there is no disturbance, that the mind is pure and clear, it doesn't mean that we now just go sack out or rest or kick up the feet and say, okay, now I don't have to meditate because the mind is fine. No, then the Buddha said, then we are happy because we see the mind is pure. We abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome state. So let's have a moment or two of silence.